name of this book is Rincon, Remote Dwelling Place, by Maud T. Gilliland. I hope, through this book, to give you a picture of life on a South Texas ranch at the turn of the century, especially the life of the Mexican vaquero, his daily work, customs, and superstitions. The title of my book comes from Rincon de Enmedia, headquarters of the vast Wells Ranch in Starr and Hidalgo counties. Rincon is a Spanish word meaning cozy corner, nook, or remote dwelling place, while the term en medio means in the middle or halfway. The Rincon, located about 35 miles north of the Rio Grande, was indeed a remote dwelling place. It consisted of 146,000 acres, and the distance from one outside gate to the other was 30 miles. My father was foreman on the Rincon, and my earliest memories are of life on this ranch. So many interesting things have happened since the publishing of this book that it would take up too much time to tell even a part of them. I have received thousands of letters from people in all walks of life. One came from the President of the United States. A friend of his bought a copy of Rincon and presented it to him in person while visiting at the White House. I autographed it thus, with best wishes to President Lyndon B. Johnson, a present-day Texas rancher. May you enjoy reading this little book about ranch life in Texas at the turn of the century. Signed, Maud T. Gilliland. Letters came from congressmen and other VIPs. One was from the director of Columbia University, New York, saying he valued Rincon as an addition to his private library. But the letters I value most are those from elderly people who say Rincon has stirred memories that were all but forgotten. My story begins with a brief account of the Turt family's journey to the Rio Grande Valley in 1902. Late in 1901, my father, Alfred Levi Truitt, who was living near Corpus Christi, signed a contract with James B. Wells of Brownsville to manage the Capasayo Ranch, located about 5 miles north of the present city of Mercedes, Texas. He went ahead to get established there and later returned for the family. He arrived in Corpus Christi with 2 wagons, a surrey, 8 mules, 4 saddle horses, and 2 buggy horses. My oldest brother Lee, who was 11 years old at the time, later told me what he remembered about the long, hot journey across the prairie to the Mexican border. The family was busy several days packing and loading furniture, bedding, and provisions on the wagons. 4 mules were hitched to each wagon, which was equipped with extra-wide wheel rims for pulling in the deep sand. Lee said, "Papa and I and 2 Mexican men were on horseback. Mama and the younger children rode in the surrey." After her trunk and boxes were loaded, she told her folks goodbye and, with the baby in her arms, took the seat beside the driver, and the slow, tedious drive to the Rio Grande began. This procession of men on horseback, followed by the mule-drawn wagons and surrey, left Corpus Christi traveling south on the old stagecoach road. This road was known as El Camino Real, or the King's Highway. In 1846, General Zachary Taylor passed along this same dusty trail, marching from Corpus Christi to Brownsville. Traveling along in this vast, unsettled country, the Truitts encountered no one for days except the Brownsville Alice stagecoach, going to and from the valley. This route covered miles and miles of shifting sand dunes. Where there was a road today, tomorrow there might be a sandbank as high as the top of the stagecoach. Lee said the Brownsville Alice stage passed us on the road every day. Looking out across this expanse of sand, we could see it coming in the distance, although we caught only a fleeting glimpse of the driver and passengers as they passed us by. We looked forward to this brief encounter each day. We watched until they were out of sight and could see the stagecoach for a long way. It finally became only a tiny black speck in the horizon. This same old stagecoach is now in the Running W Saddle Shop and Museum in Kingsville, owned by the King Ranch. The Truitts traveled during the long, hot days and camped at night. This was a desolate country. Texas was experiencing a severe drought in 1901 and 1902, and campsites with water were hard to find. After being on the road for days, they finally reached El Sauce on the King Ranch. Here they were welcomed by a friend, Uncle Josh Durham, George Durham, foreman of El South Division of the King Range, was the last survivor of McNally's Rangers. When Captain McNally died in 1877, Durham resigned and went to work for the King Range, where he worked for 60 years. Sunburned, weary, and worn, the troops were glad to reach El South. Here they were given a typical old-time Texas ranch welcome. After a supper of broiled beef, frijoles, and hot tortillas, with plenty of milk for the children, there were cool, clean beds. After several nights on the prairie, it was good to be under a roof once more. That night they fell asleep to the sound of water falling and splashing from a nearby windmill. Refreshed from their stay at El South, they prepared to resume their journey. The Mexicans filled their saddlebags and morales with carne seca and tortillas. Then, stopping by the windmill, they filled their canteens and were ready to travel. After a round of handshaking and bidding adios, one of the Mexicans, leaning over in his saddle, held back the gate while the surrey and wagons passed through. Then, galloping on ahead, he took the lead, and once more they were on their way to the Capisayo. After leaving El Camino Real, they followed winding wagon ruts through the wilderness until they finally reached Rancho Capisayo. Here, one of the Mexicans dismounted at the gate and led the horses through. Strung out behind were the other horsemen. Next came the surrey. The others, threading their way through the chaparral, were not far behind. Soon the wagon wheels jolted to a stop and the long journey was over. Here was solitude unbounded. This land was a jungle of ebony, mesquite, guajillo, and ratama, all entangled with uña de gato and tasajillo, at least 100 miles from the nearest railroad. It was here on Rancho Capisayo I was born. In 1905, the Capisayo was sold and we moved to the Rincon de Media, about 35 miles north of the present city of Mission. When we moved there, the ranch house had just been built. It had 18 rooms and 7 fireplaces, but of course no inside plumbing. However, it was well equipped with lightning rods. Across the road from the main house were the jacals, where the vaqueros and their families lived. These dirt-floored huts had but one door and were without windows. The Mexicans claimed they were built that way to keep out the evil spirits. They had no need for lightning rods on their jacales. At the approach of an electrical storm, some member of the family, usually an old woman, ran outside with a machete, slashing right and left as she circled the jacal. This, according to their superstitious belief, severed the lightning and it couldn't strike them. The old men of these families were content to pass the time squatting in the shade near their jacals, where they remained throughout the day. Their only indication of life was when they moved a little from time to time in order to stay within the shade. There were no such words as hurry in their vocabulary. Just outside the yard from the ranch house was the commissary, where provisions were kept for the Mexican families. There was sugar, flour, coffee, lard, and many other items. They bought only a dime's worth at a time. They kept their money separated, and under no circumstances would they buy lard with the dime they had reserved for sugar. Buying one article at a time, they paid for it and put it in their morale before buying the next. After making their purchases, they stood around waiting for a pilon. There, coiled up on the shelf among the canned goods, was our old pet Blacksnake. He not only kept the place free of rats, but the sight of him discouraged pilfering of any kind. Listed in my father's time book were the names of the men who worked on the Rincon. Their salaries ranged from $10 to $20 and $30 a month, according to their work. There was a cow outfit, another for grubbing, digging tanks and building and repairing fences. About half of these men were vaqueros and worked strictly with the cow outfit. The late J. Frank Dobie once said, "Most cowhands are adverse to any kind of dismounted activity." A truer statement was never made. Last on the list in the time book was Cayetano, the old pastor, or goat herder, whose salary was listed at $5. He led a life of solitude out at his goat camp. There in the brush, with only the soaring buzzard and prowling coyote to look on, Cayetano went about his work of herding his goats on the side of the hill. For weeks at a time, he saw no other human being except the vaquero who brought supplies to his camp. At night, squatting by his tiny campfire, he listened to the howl of the coyotes. And there were times when the scream of a panther pierced the night air. Then, even the coyotes would cease their howling and listen. By day, Caetano reclined in the shade of a mesquite tree with his big sombrero pulled down over his eyes. Time meant little to him. Mañana was just another day. This way of life went on day after day, year in and year out. The only excitement in his uneventful life was when a hungry panther raided his goat herd. One day he was aroused from his siesta by the frantic bleating of his goats, and hurrying to see what the commotion was, he saw a large panther in the herd killing the goats and kids. He slipped up as close as he could and shot and wounded him with a single-barrel shotgun. The wounded panther turned on the old Mexican and killed him. Captain Bill McMurray, who was then a young cowhand, was on the Rincon when the goat herder was killed. McMurray later became captain of Company D in the Texas Rangers, and he is now a prominent rancher in South Texas. These ranch Mexicans gained their knowledge of cattle and horses from the best of teachers, Mother Nature, and experience. They were an entirely different breed than the present-day ranch hands. They were content with their work and knew nothing of working and being paid by the hour. They worked by the sun. Out at cow camp, they would willingly suffer such hardships as heat, hunger, and thirst in following their daily work. This breed of cowboy, the Mexican vaquero, has vanished in the past 50 years. The following is an account of a ranch wedding and the birth and death of a baby. During the time we lived on the Rincon, my father was Justice of the Peace of Precinct 4 in Starr County, and he married many of these Mexican couples. Most of them intended to have the padre perform the marriage rites when he made one of his infrequent visits to that remote spot. Sometimes the bride and groom were blessed with two or three or more children before they took the marriage vows, but this did not keep them from having a big wedding celebration when they did take the final step. In preparing for the wedding feast in Bailey, they marked off a square of hard ground for the dance floor. Flares of tallow and kerosene were used to light up the place. The musicians usually played an accordion and a guitar, and the fact that their musical ability was limited did not deter them one bit. The sound of feet shuffling to and fro went on all night long, to the tunes of Pan de Maíz and Sobre las Olas played over and over again. At these bailes, there was plenty of food and drink, especially coffee and tamales. The daily cares were momentarily forgotten by the frequent tippling of a goatskin of mezcal. At night after supper, we usually sat on the gallery and listened to the vaqueros across the way playing their guitars and singing. My favorite place was on the floor by Mama's rocking chair, where I would listen to the grown-ups talk until my eyelids grew heavy. Then I would fight sleep until their voices trailed off to nothingness and the Sandman took over. When and how I got to bed, I never knew. There was something restful about the back-and-forth rhythm of the old-fashioned rocker, and Mama's creaking old rocking chair was never still, for there was always a nursing baby to be rocked, and no matter how hard he fell or how hard he bumped his head, his screaming miraculously ceased the moment he took the breast. As nature's oldest tranquilizer, it was a sure cure for everything, including rocked-on toes. One night, as we sat on the gallery, there was no music, and the night was dark and still. The only sound was the lonely howl of a coyote in the distance. Some sort of ritual had been going on down at the jacales all afternoon and was still in progress, when all at once the stillness was shattered by the blast of a double-barrel shotgun. I was startled, but Mama calmly went on rocking and announced, "Maria has a boy baby." Late that afternoon, Juan's compadres had gathered around in sympathetic interest, while the old barefoot patera and comadres attending Maria's labor, padded back and forth from the jacal to a large black pot out in the yard, where numerous children and dogs were playing. These children were never hampered by clothing. They usually wore a scanty shirt-like garment that struck them about the waistline, with nothing below. The men took advantage of the fire and had a pot of coffee brewing. Lighting their shuck cigarettes with coals from the fire, they squatted about in small groups, smoking and drinking coffee while awaiting Maria's delivery. When the baby finally came, Juan stepped out of his jacal and proudly announced to the world that it was un hombrecito by firing off his shotgun. Had it been a little girl, he would have announced it merely saying in a subdued tone, "Es una mujercita." The mortality rate in these infants was high, due more to ignorance than to neglect. Their babies were not born in bed. The women gave birth on a goat skin on the floor beside the bed. They kept their babies in a wooden cradle under a brush arbor or tree. The flies were bad, and there were no screens in those days. Germs were unknown to them. When they lost a child, it was heartrending to hear the wails of the Mexican women as the men went about the task of making a wooden coffin for the little one's burial. The mother lay screaming while the neighbors gathered in bunches and wailed and howled. They sounded very much like coyotes. I mean no disrespect when I say this, for I know their hearts were torn and grieved, and those cries of sorrow were the only way they knew to relieve their feelings. This wailing went on and on. Some fainted from exhaustion, while others, stimulated by this self-hypnosis, carried on hour after hour, usually until the burial took place. Only the men accompanied the remains to the grave. The women remained in a secluded room with their black shawls over their heads. Just as the Indians had their medicine men, these ranch Mexicans had their curanderos, or Mexican healers. They gathered native herbs and developed remedies for practically every ailment known to mankind. Their most common remedy for the headache was the canna plant. They wet the large leaves and tied them around their heads with a damp cloth. They rendered the oil from the rattlesnake and used it to rub their ailing joints when they had rheumatism. Their remedy for rattlesnake bite was a poultice made of prickly pear leaves mashed and mixed with goat tallow. But nothing could surpass their prickly pear poultice for its drawing effect on boils, carbuncles, and bone felons. They had as their blood tonic the boiled paisano, or roadrunner, which evidently was more potent than the present-day geritol, and old Mother Nature being what she is, the old comadres were always busy. These people were full of superstitious fears inherited from generations of ignorant forebears and brought over from Mexico over 100 years ago. They were so superstitious it was useless to try to combat their ignorance. Black magic couldn't compare with their mal de ojo or evil eye. They believed that if they admired a person, especially a baby, and didn't touch him, that some bad luck or evil would befall that person. If one was badly frightened and didn't recover shortly, his malady was diagnosed as susto, meaning literally fright. When one was deranged or highly nervous, they believed him to be embrujado, bewitched, and the treatment for this condition was to drive the devil out by tying the patient to the bed and beating him with a bull whip. This same treatment is being used by Mexican curanderos during this day and time. In fact, as recent as 1961, a Mexican woman died as a result of this treatment. An article in the San Antonio Express, dated December 16, 1961, stated, "Treatment for driving devil out results in death of Nueva Laredo woman." It then goes on to give a detailed account of the bullwhip treatment. One would think that after all these years, they would have outgrown some of these beliefs. However, once such superstition becomes fastened in the minds of these people, it is passed from generation to generation. In 1960, Hidalgo County health authorities got state help for a 4-year study by anthropologists and sociologists in dealing with the curandera problem. It still flourishes throughout the Rio Grande Valley and many other parts of Texas. They still believe in their polvitas, magic dust or powders. If sprayed or dusted around the house, it is supposed to bring good fortune, bring back lovers, straying wives or husbands, and even change your luck at cards. About the only progress the curanderos have made in the last 60 years is the fact that this stuff is now available in pressurized aerosol containers with handy push-button tops. One of the most famous curanderos in Starr County was Don Pedrito Jaramillo. His miraculous cures are legendary in South Texas. It is said that Don Pedrito first came into this country from Guadalajara, Mexico, in 1881, when he accompanied a group of Mexicans taking a supply of liquor for a holy day celebration at Las Cabras Ranch. South Texas at that time was a barren land with little civilization and no doctors. Don Pedrito settled on Las Olmas Creek in what was then Starr County and declared himself a faith healer or curandero. As his fame spread, thousands of the sick and lame came to him from near and far to seek his aid. He made no charges for his services. Among his remedies for certain ailments was wearing shoes filled with canned tomatoes and sleeping in wet clothes for a period of 9 days. He also prescribed the drinking of beer while taking a bath. I imagine this last remedy proved to be more popular with his patients than the first two. Don Pedrito not only doctored the ailing who came to his hut on Las Olmas Creek, but traveled over South Texas on horseback, drawing crowds wherever he went. Incredible as it seems, there are those among his believers in South Texas who still seek his remedies. At the present time, 2 volumes of a book describing his cures constantly circulate from the Alice, Texas Library. Alice, Texas, about 55 miles north of the Rincon, was the traditional ranger station for Southwest Texas during that time, and many of the rangers stationed there made the Rincon their headquarters when scouting in that vicinity. Among them were Captain John Hughes, Captain Bill McDonald, Captain Tom Ross, and Ranger Gus T. Jones, who later gained fame with the FBI, where he served from 1916 to 1944. These rangers were welcome visitors at the ranch. Any visitors at the Rincon were made welcome. Those were the days when a man shared his grub and campfire with his fellow man. But Papa always kept a loaded 30-30 Winchester within easy reach, for some of the visitors could very well be bandits or horse thieves. This area where we lived was known as the backcountry. This endless expanse of mesquite and prickly pear north of the Rio Grande was also the home of numerous smugglers and bandits who made their living stealing cattle, horses, and mules. Many nights Papa slept out on the porch with his gun nearby. When he rode out, he always buckled on his six-shooter and carried his rifle in the scabbard on his saddle. The Mexican horse thieves and cattle rustlers were constantly on the prowl, and when they accidentally encountered the rangers, they took to the brush, sparing neither quirt nor spurs until they reached the Rio Grande. These hard-riding bandidos, with their large rowels, spurs, and bighorn saddles, continued to prey on the herds of the backcountry ranchmen for several years. They feared and hated Los Rinches, the rangers, who did more to quell them than any other organization. The presence of rangers on the Rincon not only discouraged cattle rustling in that vicinity, but ended many bandit careers as well. Our day on the ranch started early. Around 4:30 or 5 o'clock each morning, we could hear the grinding of the old coffee mill and smell the freshly ground coffee. The mill was nailed to the wall just outside the kitchen door. There on the ranch, we followed the old Mexican custom of taking a siesta during the hottest part of the day. Usually by 2 o'clock, everything on the ranch was sound asleep. Even the noisy paisanos had found a shade and settled down, and the old buggy horses stood under the big mesquite tree, dozing and switching the noonday flies. Around 3, we could hear Tomasa rattling around in the kitchen, starting a fire in the old wood stove. The best eye-opener in the world is the smell of mesquite smoke mixed with the delicious aroma of boiling coffee. About 4 every afternoon, without fail, we had coffee and tea cakes or pandusi. Despite the fact that we had no refrigeration in those days, we usually had some kind of fresh meat. Game was plentiful, and we had venison when we wanted it. Occasionally, when a beef was killed, we not only ate the fresh meat, but cut it in thin strips and dried it in the sun. At that time, the clothesline was full of jerky. The flavor of jerked beef in stews cannot be equaled. About twice a week, Mama baked big crusty loaves of light bread in the old wood stove. This stove had four lids and a good-sized firebox. Mesquite wood was cut just to fit it. We usually used pine to start the fire, but on cold mornings when we were in a hurry, the lids were sometimes hurled a foot in the air when the kerosene ignited. The heavy iron tea kettle was kept steaming, and simmering on the back of the stove was usually a pot of frijoles. We knew nothing about protein, minerals, or vitamins in those days, but we knew that the frijoles not only tasted good, but stuck to our ribs. I remember the long dining table with the caster set in the middle. Even with this long table, when a whole company of rangers were there, we had to wait second table. This was the longest wait in the world. Seated on a bench out in the hall, with the tantalizing aroma of good food wafting through right under our nose, was sheer torture. I kept my ear cocked for any telltale sounds that relief was in sight, and I knew the waiting was about over when I heard the creaking and cracking of the chairs as the eaters shifted their weight and leaned back after a good, satisfying meal. Then it seemed an eternity until they pushed away from the table and moved out on the gallery. For entertainment on the ranch, we had a phonograph. Some called it the Victor Talking Machine. The trademark was, and still is, a white dog sitting there with his head cocked to one side, listening to his master's voice. This machine, with its cylinder records and big brass Morning Glory horn, was the latest thing in 1908. It was not kept blaring constantly as the present-day radios and televisions are. We had special times to play it, and it was a rare treat to sit and listen spellbound as we played Red Wing, Listen to the Mockingbird, Tell Mother I'll Be There, and several of Enrico Caruso's songs, and John Philip Sousa's band. To us, it was one of the wonders of the world to be able to hear music and voices coming from the little wax cylinders. On one occasion, we let the Mexicans see and hear the talking machine. They eyed it with suspicion. Some thought El Diablo was in the box and kept a safe distance. We played such games as Wolf Over the River, Ante Over, Hull Gull, and a counting out game called William a Trembletoe. Our pets, besides dogs and cats, were deer, coons, javelina, and armadillos. The vaqueros brought us these pets, and there was a never-ending source of supply out there in the brush where they came from. There on the ranch, we were many miles from the nearest doctor, and there was no such thing as a first aid kit in those days. Our thermometer was Mama's cool hand on our fevered brow. On the mantel board over the fireplace was a bottle of castor oil, castoria, and camphor. Another bottle contained lightning oil, labeled for man or beast. Of course, we had our share of accidents and ailments, but Mama knew just what to do, even when one of the children stuffed a bean up his nose or held his breath. When Papa had to be away, Mama spent many hours, days, and weeks alone with the children there on the range. Of course, the faithful cowhands were there. I often wonder what a modern mother would do under the same circumstances. I also wonder how Mama did it. She was happy as she went about her work. She patched, darned, and sewed. She sang songs and told us stories. She gave us love and affection and a good wearing out with a switch when we needed it. If she ever cried, it was in secret. I have often heard her say, lo que será, será. That which will be, will be. She spoke the Mexican language like a native. Molly Truitt, who braved the dangers and endured the hardships of pioneer ranch life, was one of the old-fashioned mothers who have grown all too few with the passing of years. In 1911, the Rincon was leased to the Russell and East Cattle Company. Tom T. East, son-in-law of R.J. Clareberg, Sr., operated the ranch for many years after that. Our ranch days were now over, and we moved to Mission, a new town being built 35 miles south of there. The morning we left, the vaqueros and their families gathered in front of their jacals to bid us goodbye. No better friends were to be had than those faithful ranch Mexicans. Few words were spoken, aside from the limp handshake. They just stood without a word. From our place in the back end of the wagon, we could see them standing in the road, shading their eyes against the morning sun as they watched us leave. Then above the noise of the creaking ox cart and wagons, we heard the words, Vaya con Dios, as we rode away. After traveling most of the day, we reached Mission, where we saw hundreds of Mexicans clearing land. They were from across the river and wore big sombreros and rawhide huaraches. The name wetback had not come into use at that time. These Mexican people had, for 100 years or more, crossed the Rio Grande at will. Until 1917, there were no restrictions on immigration from Mexico, except on Chinese nationals. With new towns springing up all along the valley, these laborers came over by the thousands to clear land. Mexico revolutions kept the border in a constant uproar from 1910 to 1920, and we had barely settled in Mission when the bandit trouble broke out. By 1915, Mexican bandits were crossing over and raiding ranches and villages all along the river. In 1918, the Rincon was divided into small tracts and sold. Today, the remaining 76,000 acres, now the Arrowhead Range, is owned by millionaire Lloyd M. Benson, father of U.S. Senator Lloyd Benson. After reading Rincon, Mr. and Mrs. Benson invited my family and me to spend the weekend at their range. Needless to say, I found this ultra-modern range quite different than the old Rincon. The ranch now has some 30,000 acres in cultivation, with 10,000 acres of buffalo grass pasture, and some of the finest oil and gas fields in the nation. So, what was once a remote dwelling place has become one of the most valuable properties in South Texas. A description of this fabulous ranch house is found on page 102 of my book. Near the house is a landing strip and hangars for the planes. The old days of the Rincon are gone forever, and with them a way of life that shall never return. My story ends with memories of the ranch. I have always heard, look forward, never look back. They say living in the past is a sign of old age, but I'm a firm believer in the old adage, there is a time and place for everything, and I believe there's a time for living in the past. There comes a time in everyone's life when the only way he can look is back. And we will all reach that period if we live long enough. Anyone who has never, at some time when he was young, lived on a ranch, or at least in the country, has missed something in life. It is nice to have ranch memories stored away in your past to draw on when the looking back period comes, and it will come to all of us sooner or later. Memories such as the ceniza, pitaya, and nopal in full bloom, and the lace-like shadows of the mesquite under a noonday sun, the paisana folding back his wings as he skims across the road, the music of strumming guitars as the vaqueros sing their canciones de amor when day is done, the yip-yip-yipping of the coyote, followed by a long, lonesome howl and the answers of his friends on a faraway hill, tired, thirsty horses drinking long and deep from the old wooden trough and rolling as soon as they are saddle-free, the palsied squeak of the old windmill, and the lowing of cattle coming to water. The old herd bull bellowing his troubles to the world as he lumbers down the sendero. The dry, shrill song of the locust, and the always silent buzzard circling high on a clear, hot day. The smell of horses, the sound of creaking leather, and the clinking, clanking sound of spurs. The clean smell of cool, damp earth after a good soaking rain, and such familiar things as saddles, slickers, bridles, boots, and spurs. All these help make looking back a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Gillum. I sure do appreciate this, and I know that all them facts and some of the stories you have told, they've interested me, and I know that they're going to interest my audience when they have time to listen to them. And I know Dr. Hunter would probably really like this tape a lot because he's really interested in the South Texas area, and you've been from this area and lived here most all your life, and some of the stories that you have told are really interesting, and I sure thank you very much.